It's been 11 years now this month that me and the other people on the Great March for Climate Action crawled out of the Front Range of the Rocky Mountains and came onto the prairie. And I'm going to share that chapter of my book with you. The book is Marcher, Walker, Pilgrim. It's my memoir from the Great March for Climate Action. And I just feel like sharing this today. So there. Anyway, I think you'll enjoy it. The chapter is called Storms on the Prairie. And I'll read you the, before each chapter, I have a quote from somebody who I think says something that fits in really well with the content of the chapter. And this is from Keith Jacobshagen in a book called The Changing Prairie. He writes, "The question is always asked by the curious travelers who have crossed the plains at interstate speeds, how can you live here without the mountains, the ocean, the woods? But what they are really speaking to is their desire to, quote, get it right away. The sublime of this place that we call the prairie is one of patience and looking." I like that. Okay, so here's what I wrote in that chapter 23. On June 7, we reached the highest point of our march, crossing the Front Range at 9,420 feet. Since we usually change elevation at a gradual pace, altitude sickness hasn't been a problem for most marchers. Our biggest climb in one day was a 3,000-foot ascent of the Mugian Rim in Arizona. Today, the elevation change is again 3,000 feet, all downhill, as we plunge toward the western edge of the Great Plains. Our trek through Colorado has gone well. We've had perfect weather and a mostly quiet route through the mountains. Without the disruption of traffic and trains, sleep has been more restful. Marchers seem less physically and emotionally stressed. The march community is more harmonious than at any point since the Mojave Desert. Foregoing my salary has helped too, diffusing the hostility directed toward me in particular and toward staff in general. Jimmy follows suit and now works as a full-time volunteer. When Kelsey learns that I'm no longer paid, she victoriously rejoins the march in Colorado Springs. I welcome her back, though without enthusiasm, as I am certain she'll soon find a new way to sow discord. Colorado Springs is a success. At our rally, Mary Barber, the director of Sustainable Fort Carson, shares how the U.S. Army is responding to climate change. Congress may ignore 35 marchers demanding climate action, but if the U.S. military speaks up, Congress might listen. Marchers are polite and attentive during Mary's speech, but one local heckles Mary, calling her a warmonger. Denver follows quickly on the heels of Colorado Springs. Chris Viveris, our state coordinator, has worked with a coalition of nonprofit groups to pull together an excellent rally that's followed by a short march, then a meeting with Sean McGrath, the regional head of the EPA. Later, Steve and I speak at a fundraising event that raises $500. With Jimmy and I now unpaid, the march's fundraising goal is noticeably lighter. My weekly target is $7,500. Other marchers have stepped forward to help too, launching a creative appeal called Shave the Planet. As each new fundraising benchmark is met, another marcher's head is shorn. My follic-deprived dome is the first victim. By the end of the drive, nearly one out of every five marchers is bald. We raise around $15,000 and compost a whole lot of hair. On June 18th, we marched north and east out of Denver on the first leg of our journey across the Great Plains. "Goodbye, barren deserts and rugged mountains. Hello, lush, rolling prairie," I say to Steve as we suck down a second breakfast at a little cafe along the route. "Well, maybe for you," replies Steve, "but I'm more than a bit nervous. Your lush prairie is infamous for scorching heat, high humidity, and killer tornadoes. Can't say I'm thrilled about any of that." "Look," I say, "if we start really early, like 4:30 or 5 o'clock, we beat the heat. And humidity, great stuff. No more dry skin and chapped lips. Once you get used to it, humidity feels like a warm, moist blanket caressing your body. And tornadoes, there's nothing more thrilling than watching one of those bad boys tear through a field. If it comes at you, all you got to do is dive in a ditch and it'll skip right over." Steve looks at me skeptically, shaking his head. Yeah, you're so damn glad to be back on the flat ground, you've gone all stupid in the head. We pause to eavesdrop on a conversation between two farmers at a nearby table. One mentions that he took a piece of equipment in for repairs, quote, a couple 3 weeks ago. I smile broadly at this distinctly Midwestern phrase, one I haven't heard in months. I say to Steve, am I glad to be back on the prairie? You betcha. A strong storm hits as we arrive at our campsite at Prairie View High School in Henderson. I'm ready to pronounce a miserable end to our first day on the prairie when a brilliant double rainbow paints the eastern sky as the sun sinks into the Front Range. The hardship of setting up camp, cooking and eating while dodging thunderbolts in a deluge is forgotten in this moment of sublime natural glory. But that moment is itself short-lived as a threat we've never considered strikes suddenly and forcefully. At the far end of the ball field, where my tent is pitched, the school's sprinkler system goes off. All I can do is watch and hope that the powerful stream hitting my tent every 30 seconds doesn't drench the inside. I'm grateful the fly is tight to the ground, but some of my gear gets wet anyway. I warn marshers that other sprinklers are likely to go off. They don't take me seriously until the next one pops up directly under Kim's tent, blasting a steady stream of water into the floor and soaking much of her and Liz Lafferty's gear. Most marchers now hustle to move their tents. Some get drenched anyway. When the sprinklers are done beating us up, a second thunderstorm rolls in. My welcome home to the prairie is complete, accompanied by a mere 3 hours sleep. The next 2 days' marches are 17 miles each. Skies in shades of black, gray, and green bring more strong storms that include hail and funnel clouds. Our route follows the railroad tracks, and throughout the night, the train's whistles assault us every half hour or so. My earplugs are worthless, the whistles tearing through them like a cougar shreds lamb flesh. The ongoing symphony of thunder and train whistles assures my third consecutive night of only a few hours of fitful sleep. I crawl out of my tent in the morning feeling utterly battered and exhausted. To add to these joys, Kelsey wastes no time in launching her next campaign. She's upset that we use a low-mileage, fossil fuel-powered truck to move our gear. She lays out a plan for each of us to haul our own gear using strollers and rickshaws. She argues that if we want to drive home the urgency of climate change, all of us, not just her, have to make greater sacrifices. Quote, we aren't suffering enough, she says as part of her sales pitch, to which Miriam replies, I'm 71. I've marched every step of the way. I'm suffering all the time, and I'm not pushing my gear in a baby carriage. Kelsey's obsession with the gear truck is draining. Worse still, Jimmy rekindles his effort to gain control of the march. He argues that the website should be managed by, quote, marchers, and by that he means people who travel with the march regardless of whether they often or ever actually march. After we left California, I hired Kai to be our communications director. She's in charge of the website, which by any objective standard looks compelling and professional. Jimmy tries to convince me it's badly managed, yet I refute each of the points he raises. Frustrated that I won't turn the website over to him, Jimmy and two other, quote, marchers, drive, to meet me on the road. I'm pissed off and feel ganged up on. I listen to them for a bit, but my patience is thin. I interrupt and tell Jimmy he's trying to undermine a hardworking coworker, a trained professional who's doing the job we hired her to do. I tell the three of them that if they want to do something productive, they should march. They keep pushing. I lose my temper. We've got Kelsey trying to get rid of the gear truck because we burn too much fossil fuel. We've got you driving all over the place, burning fossil fuel when you should be marching. I'm done with this conversation. Go back to your air-conditioned cafe if you want. I'm here to march, I say as I storm off. The route from Rogan to Wiggins, Colorado, proves unworkable. There's no road, and we're stuck with two illegal options, the train tracks or the interstate highway. After a few frustrating miles treading through the loose sand along the tracks, Steve opts to cut across a slice of range land and walk the interstate. The rest of us continue along the tracks for about 15 miles. The challenge of walking through sand coupled with 3 days of sleep deprivation is devastating. I'm a walking zombie when I stagger into our camp on the lawn of a church. Sarah and John Jorgensen are there to meet me, and I can tell by the worried look on their faces that I've truly hit the wall. Sarah comes to my rescue and finds a homestay. By mid-afternoon, I'm sound asleep and remain blissfully unconscious for an impressive 15 hours. Steve and I set out the next morning from Wiggins. I don't think I've ever slept that long, ever, I say. Between storms, sprinklers, sand, and sleeplessness, I was like a dead man walking yesterday. Still loving your damn prairie? Quips Steve. Whatever, I snap. It'll get better. I'm sure it will, says Steve. But here's what's not going to get better. All this squabbling, these power struggles. Kelsey going off on the gear truck. Jimmy and Lala and these others who complain and make trouble instead of marching. I got to tell you, Ed, I've had enough. I know this isn't what you want to hear, but I'm going to leave the march. I stopped dead in my tracks. If there was one thing I never expected to hear, it was Steve saying he'd quit. He'd been more vocal than anyone about the importance of marching every step of the way. And after hobbling along for 33 miles on crutches in the Mojave Desert, I figured he'd drag himself on his belly to Washington, D.C. if he had to. I stand there, dumbfounded. I've been thinking, and I've got an idea, says Steve. Marchers are talking about taking a 4-day break to go to New York for the People's Climate March in late September. Wouldn't it be powerful if one of us made that trek on foot? If the longest climate march in history met up with the largest? There's only one marcher who can do that, and that's me. It'd mean walking a lot, 25 and 30 mile days, and I'd have to haul my own gear, but I think I can do it. I struggle for a response, and for lack of anything meaningful to add, say, well, you hauling your own gear, that sure made Kelsey proud. Steve laughs a bit, then gets serious again. I hate the stupid stuff that's going on in this camp, and I just can't take it anymore. I know it's even harder on you, Ed, and if you want out, you're welcome to join me. We stand together on the side of the road, me squinting into the rising sun, leaning hard on my stick. I kick a rock in front of me and say, I'd sure like to get away from this mess, but I can't. I can't leave what I started, no matter how bad it gets. I've got to keep going. Grind it out with everyone else, even the crazies and the power-hungry ones who want me to quit. Despite the few who are problems, there's mostly good folks here and a whole lot of people back home who are counting on me, counting on us. I can't quit on them. We walk on in silence. I'm sad. I don't want Steve to leave, but I can hardly blame him. After a while, I say, well, I got to admit, it's a great plan. I see the lead line in the story. In the battle for climate action, one battered warrior walks over 3,000 miles to join the largest climate march ever. At Fort Morgan, the prairie skies continue their homecoming celebration with another huge storm, the biggest yet. We hurriedly clean up supper's mess as strong winds rip and tear the trees above us. The wind is followed by intense rain that sends a torrent rushing through our camp. A stream of water over a foot deep. Some tents actually survive the deluge. Marchers move others, and some are knocked over. Some marchers, including me, escape to a nearby hotel. The next day, we walk by entire cornfields cut to the ground by last night's hail. 12 hours after the storm, the hail still lies on the warm ground in thick piles, which from a distance look like snowdrifts. Locals I talk with tell me this is the worst string of storms they've ever seen, making the conversation about climate change a bit easier. The clouds improve, but the scenery doesn't. We pass feedlots that stretch along the road for over a mile. So far into the distance, they fade from sight. Marchers, omnivore, vegetarian, and vegan alike, are appalled by this wasteland crammed tight with the living corpses of millions of cattle. In camp that evening, a few marchers become vegans in response. One young convert poetically declares, "Meat is like the flesh of babies and dairy, the lubricant that grinds the very wheels of hell." I appreciate the colorful metaphors, but argue that the problem's not meat, but the way it's raised. Yet reason is lost on urban innocents who've only known meat as a pretty package on a grocery store shelf, who now stand in shock as their eyes are pried open to one of industrial agriculture's many dark secrets. The next day, Steve sets out on his own. We shake hands and I wish him luck. I tell him I'll see him on the coast. I know he'll make it, but I also know it'll be rough, a dangerous haul alone on highways that will get busier the farther east he goes. I reassure him that the harshness and emptiness of the high Colorado plains won't be an issue in Iowa. The tall grass prairie is a friendlier landscape, Steve, I say. You'll see. You'll be there soon enough, at least a week before the rest of us. Iowans will treat you right, even though they'll think you're a weirdo pushing a baby stroller along the highway, and that funny accent of yours. And Iowa ain't flat, so get that notion out of your head. I watch Steve set out on his 1,500-mile solo walk, watch him grow faint in the distance, pushing that stroller, looking every bit as out of place as the early settlers must have looked in their covered wagons. Maybe someday we'll learn how to live with the prairie, not just come in, tear the whole thing up, and let it wash away to the Gulf of Mexico. I think of Lauren Lown, a friend and conservationist from Des Moines, who was quoted a few years back saying, "We have left less than 0.1% of our prairie. The rest of it died to make Iowa safe for soybeans." I've been looking forward to Nebraska because of the prominence of the Keystone Pipeline in the fight for climate action. Our state coordinator, Anna Wishart, has done amazing work lining up local contacts and assembling an impressive amount of donated food, much of it locally grown. As we enter Nebraska on June 30th, I'm excited about our prospects for making a difference here. But the two marchers I've grown closest to, Shira and Steve, are gone. Conflicts with other marchers threaten to gain momentum, and I feel increasingly isolated and uneasy as we approach the halfway point of the march. I felt like sharing that. That's the chapter 23 from my book, Marcher, Walker, Pilgrim. Quite an experience. And yeah, I was happy to be back on the prairie, and I'm happy to continue to live on the prairie.